Now, the top of the hour on the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn presents the Green News Report.
I'm happy to say we reached consensus.
Just not on climate change with the U.S. at the G20.
Time is running out. Leaders of the world, you must lead.
A warning for a world at a crossroads as talks begin at the annual UN Climate Summit. Plus,
successful economic development and environmental protection go hand in hand.
The somewhat surprising environmental legacy of the late President George H.W. Bush.
All of those somewhat surprises and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
And if we want our kids to know that the joy that we've known, we've got to make sure that the Earth, with its incredible regenerative capability, can restore what we've taken.
Nice thought. Maybe you should have mentioned that to your kid before he became president, Mr. Bush. This is your Green News Report.
I'm gonna soak up the sun.
Okay, Desi Doyen, a lot of crossroads, a lot of summits, a lot of politics in today's Green News Report.
Yes. First, the surprising environmental legacy of George H.W. Bush, the 41st president of the United States, who died last Friday. His policies were mixed, but he was instrumental in some landmark environmental policies. He signed the world's first international climate treaty, the Montreal Protocol, that is now succeeding in repairing the planet's protective ozone layer. He signed a major expansion of the Clean Air Act that addressed acid rain and smog-forming pollutants, and it provided the legal and regulatory basis for the Obama administration's climate change policies. And remember that dire National Climate Assessment report that the Trump administration tried to bury on Black Friday?
I do.
Yep. Bush signed that law that requires that report on climate impacts every 4 years. Bush 41's environmental legacy is a stark contrast, of course, to today's science-denying Republican Party and the Trump administration.
It certainly is. And there's a lot of things I could say, but won't for the moment, about George H.W. Bush and his presidency. But when it comes to his environmental legacy, it wasn't fantastic. But in comparison to what the Republican Party has become, including his own son, George W. Bush, and of course, Donald Trump, well, I miss the good old days, I guess.
Meanwhile, at the G20 meeting in Buenos Aires over the weekend, 19 of the 20 world leaders gathered at the summit signed a joint communique pledging to join together to fight climate change, which Trump refused to sign until the U.S. delegation carved out a special paragraph just for the U.S., reiterating Trump's intention to withdraw from the United Nations Paris Climate Agreement and with thinly veiled support for fossil fuels. And according to a comprehensive new report measuring progress toward the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement, among the G20 nations, 15 reported that their emissions have actually increased over last year, and only India is on course to meet its stated targets to cut emissions.
A, that's not good news. B, didn't Republicans spend a whole bunch of years telling us that China and India would never sign on to reduce fossil fuel emissions?
You mean they spent many years lying about China and India?
Point taken.
Now, global leaders are in Poland for the 24th Conference of the Parties to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, or COP24 for short.
Which is being held in coal country and sponsored by the coal industry.
Indeed. Host nation Poland got its coal industry to sponsor the conference and is literally decking the halls of the exhibition center with piles of coal.
Really?
Yes, really.
Oh, my God.
The goal of this year's conference is to write the rule book on mechanisms for countries to meet the emissions reduction targets that nearly 200 countries agreed to in the Paris Climate Agreement back in 2015. It's also supposed to figure out how they will report, how they will verify their progress, and also to increase financial support for hard-hit developing countries. In his speech opening COP24, British documentary filmmaker and environmental activist Sir David Attenborough spoke of the urgency of a world at a crossroads.
If we don't take action, the collapse of our civilizations and the extinction of much of the natural world is on the horizon. And as the Paris Agreement proved, together we can make real change happen.
We should note that Trump's intention to withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Climate Accord can't actually occur until the day after the 2020 U.S. presidential election. However, he has succeeded in undermining the agreement and encouraging other countries like Australia, Brazil, and Poland to backslide. But there is some good news from COP24. The World Bank announced on Monday it will invest a record $100 billion to fund adaptation and mitigation projects in developing countries.
Didn't the World Bank just a few weeks ago say they would no longer fund any coal projects anywhere in the world?
That they did.
So, see, there's some progress.
Indeed.
For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find us, follow us, and share us worldwide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Please help Progressive Voices support the Green News Report by stopping by bradblog.com/donate.
Hello, this is Terrence McNally, and this week, as various Trump cronies are caught up in Mueller's dragnet, let's look at how our justice system works for the little guy. You'll hear my 2006 conversation about the documentary After Innocence on the work of the Innocence Project. It features director-producer-writer Jessica Sanders, producer-writer Mark Simon, and exonerated former prisoner Herman Abbott.
Imagine this. You're driving in an unfamiliar neighborhood. You turn into the parking lot of a convenience store to ask for directions. You buy a six-pack. You're in the store for maybe a couple of minutes. You're walking back to your car when a police car barrels into the parking lot. Startled, you look around. What attracted their attention? When a bright light suddenly shines in your eyes, you're their target. You're arrested. You're accused of rape. You're convicted by eyewitness testimony by a frightened young woman you've never seen before. And you're sentenced to prison for 10, 20, 30 years, the rest of your life. This happens more than you could ever imagine. Now, and over the last several years, due to DNA evidence, we are learning with certainty about just how often these wrongful convictions take place. And thankfully, individual human beings trapped in these horrifying situations due to the same DNA evidence are now being exonerated and freed. Here on Freeform, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect hold pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, health, science, politics, media, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. A new documentary film, After Innocence, opening Friday the 13th at the New Art in West L.A., tells the compelling stories of the exonerated, innocent men wrongfully imprisoned for years, then released after the DNA evidence proves their innocence. The film focuses on the stories of seven men thrust back into society with little or no support from the system. After Innocence shows that the human toll of wrongful imprisonment can last far longer than the sentences served. It also features Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld, former guests on Free Forum, the founders of the Innocence Project, which has helped to exonerate more than 150 people freed through the use of DNA testing in the last decade. Also includes human rights activist Dr. Lola Vollen, who's co-founder of the Life After Exoneration program. We see firsthand in the film the hard fact that eyewitness identification can be wildly inaccurate. A white woman in the film was raped by a black man, identified the wrong person, sending him to jail for a crime he did not commit, and the two of them now work together against mistaken eyewitness identification. He, as you can imagine, is one of those freed by the DNA evidence. Most states don't have transition or compensation programs for the exonerated. Released from jail after decades, sometimes victims are thrown into the world, in some cases, without even an apology. Often their records are not expunged, making it difficult to get an apartment or a job. The exonerated get less social services in the form of health care, job training, housing, and mental health support than parolees. Parolees, who we assume are guilty, versus these exonerated who have been proven innocent. I say, see this film, let it affect you, and tell others to see it. The guests joining me today are Jessica Sanders, the director, producer, and writer of the film, Mark Simon, the producer and writer, Herman Atkins, one of the exonerated, Dennis Mayer, one of the exonerated, and J.W. Carney, the attorney who was the prosecutor of Dennis Mayer. Now, before I bring them in, I'm going to give you a little bit more bio information on each of them, and then we're going to start you know, the interviews. Jessica Sanders, the director, producer, and writer, is an Academy Award-nominated filmmaker. She works in fiction and nonfiction. She produced the film Sing, which received Oscar and Emmy nominations in 2002 and aired nationally on PBS. She was an associate producer on the 2003 Oscar-winning documentary short film Twin Towers and series associate producer camera operator on Dick Wolf's NBC documentary series Crime and Punishment. She's an alumna of the Independent Feature Projects Project Involve and the Filmmakers Producers Lab. Mark Simon, who will be joining us in a few minutes, he won't be on at the very top of the show, the producer and writer, is a graduate of the Benjamin Cardozo School of Law and an alumnus of the Innocent Projects. It was that experience which inspired the making of After Innocence. He's also an associate at the law firm of Dreyer LLP in New York City, and he currently works as a legal correspondent and producer for Fox Television's A Current Affair. Herman Atkins, the son of a California Highway Patrol officer, was convicted in 1988 by an L.A. jury of forcible rape, robbery, and for using a handgun in the commission of these crimes. Based on DNA test results in February 2000, after 13 years in prison for a crime he did not commit, Herman Atkins was exonerated and released from prison. He's attending college and recently got his Bachelor of Science in Psychology and plans to go on for his master's. Herman actually was a guest on this program on the first year anniversary of his exoneration. In 1984, Dennis Mayer was convicted of rape, assault with intent to rape, assault and battery in both Lowell and Ayer, Massachusetts. First working as his own attorney for 16 years while in prison and finally receiving support from the Innocence Project, he was exonerated by DNA evidence and released April 3, 2003. He works the night shift as a mechanic for Waste Management, is engaged to Melissa Valcourt, and they became the proud parents of Elijah Mayer, first baby born in Nashua, Massachusetts, on New Year's Day in 2005. Welcome all of you to KPFK and Free Forum. Let me start, Jessica, with you. Tell us, what was it that led you to make this film?
As a filmmaker, you know, I'm always looking for dynamic stories, and I was working on that series called Crime and Punishment, following the prosecution side of criminal trials, and through that I really saw how adversarial the system was. And through friends, I got an email from Mark Simon, who was a former student at the Innocence Project. And it was his experience there, and especially meeting Herman Atkins, who's with us today, that he realized that there's no attention to the plight of the exonerees once they are released from prison. And the first scene of the film is when I was in New York for the 10th anniversary of the Innocence Project, and I met 30 exonerees, and I was so impressed and moved by their stories and how they weren't bitter and, you know, they were just really positive people, and I knew that, you know, it would be an inspiring film, but also that change could happen with a film like this. And also, it was just an incredibly dynamic story. So I just kind of said, I want to do this.
Right. Mark, as soon as you get those earphones on, I've introduced everyone, including you, and just asked her how the film happened. And, of course, in telling that story, she says how you were instrumental. So to you, you're now working as a lawyer, but you have your hand in the media. How did you connect with Jessica, and how did this story happen? And you share a little bit about your time at the Innocence Project, if you would.
Sure. And, of course, Los Angeles traffic is always interesting for us New Yorkers, so thanks for getting me on. It's really a great story. I mean, Herman, in meeting him, truly was an inspiration. Getting to go out to dinner with him, you know, within a week after him having been exonerated, and feeling the inspiration that's within him, really was eye-opening. And so throughout my year in the Innocence Project, I met other exonerees, and I was struck by the fact that no one's looking at their stories about what happens after that day when they're in the newspapers and they're in the magazines and the television screen, and I wanted to do something about that. And so this film was the answer to that. And one night I was sitting there writing a treatment. I think I had called Herman and said, you know, I have this idea. What do you think? And he said, you know, go for it. And I was writing the original treatment, and a friend called me, said, what are you doing? It was late night at my law firm. I said, I'm writing a treatment for this documentary, but I've only worked in features. I said, I need to meet a documentarian. She said, well, why don't you call my sister's friend? And I said, who's your sister's friend? And she said, Jessica Sanders. And I said, is she a documentarian or is she a documentarian? And she said, well, I know she's being nominated for an Oscar in a month or two. I said, that's good enough for me.
So, why not start at the bottom?
Yeah. And that is how Jessica and I came to meet each other. And, God, that is 4 years ago, over 4 years ago. So it's been quite a journey.
Since I want people to really get a feeling for the human stories underlying all of this, let me go right now first to Dennis, because, and then we'll get to you, Herman. I want to get Dennis so that we can make sure that we get J.W. Carney, your prosecutor, during the window that he's going to be with us. So, Dennis Mayer, take the time you need to tell us your story. What immediately preceded arrest, the story of conviction, prison, your campaign? If you can do it in, you know, 3, 4, 5 minutes, that would be great.
Well, first, hello. I was a soldier in the U.S. Army when I was arrested. I was walking down the street. I stopped and picked up a six-pack to go to my friend's house to watch a hockey game. I was walking down the street, and all of a sudden, cop cars come out of everywhere, like 4 or 5 cop cars, and they stopped me and started questioning me, you know, and I said, well, what's going on? And they said, well, where were you? And then they searched me, and they arrested me for possession of marijuana. So they took me down to the jail, and they questioned me, and then they questioned me again later on that night. And they says, so finally I says, well, what are you questioning me for? And they says, well, we're questioning you for a rape that happened last night and attempted rape that happened tonight. And I says, well, I think I need a lawyer. So I goes into the courtroom. They have an in-court identification. One of the victims identifies someone else, so they dropped all the charges against me. So I went to leave the courthouse, and they arrested me again on the same charges. And I got bailed out on that later on, and then I went back to Fort Devens in the military. On January 5th of 1984, I was arrested and charged with another rape in Ayer, which is right outside of Fort Devens, well, where Fort Devens used to be. And so a few months later, I went to trial, was convicted, sentenced to 20 to 30 years. A month later, I went to another trial and was sentenced to second-degree life. And probably 3 years later, I was found to be a sexually dangerous person and sentenced to 1 day to natural life. So there was no way I was getting out of prison.
Okay, Dennis, let me ask you a couple of questions about that. So sounds like first of all, let me establish, they were correct about possession of marijuana?
Yes.
Okay, so they had a reason for the law to grab you. Once they had
I was walking down the street minding my own business. They just pulled up in cop cars, stopped me, and searched me.
Right. In other words, so with no probable cause, they shouldn't have been able even to search you. I understand. Okay, but what I was just establishing was messy how they got you, but you were guilty of what regrettably in this country, what ridiculously and absurdly in this country is a crime, which is possession of marijuana.
Right.
But then they pinned you with these other charges. What was the grounds on which you were convicted? Was it mistaken identification?
Witness identification.
And so so in other words, since it was more than one rape, more than one individual, they had separate individuals who both mistakenly identify you.
They had three individuals.
And all three of them identified you.
Right.
Looking back, do you have any idea how that happened?
Well, in one of the lineups, I was standing. Everyone else was standing behind a railing, and I was standing behind a chair. That's the one lineup I really remember.
You know, I will share this with you, and I don't know if I've shared it with anyone else here. I was held at gunpoint in my home a few years ago when the police captured someone and brought me in to do identification. They had 6 pictures. 5 of them were against one background, and 1 was against the different background. Very similar to the thing you're talking about.
So
that's the one you remember. So in other words, 3 different people who we can assume, as I mentioned in the intro, were frightened, panicked, and so on, identified you, and you were sent to prison for, getting back to your story, for what would have been the rest of your life.
Right.
So then you began 16 years of working as your own attorney?
Yep. Well, roughly between 14 and 16 years. And then I saw the Innocence Project on Phil Donahue. So I wrote to the Innocence Project, and they agreed to represent me. And they filed a motion for new trial in front of my original trial judge. He denied it without a hearing. So I was getting desperate after that. So I wrote to Jay Carney, who was the DA that prosecuted me, and I asked him for help. Well, I never heard back from him, but all of a sudden a reporter from the Boston Globe showed up and talked to me, and he said, Judge Barton's retiring in 6 months. So the day Judge Barton retired, I called the Innocence Project again, and they says, well, we're not supposed to take this phone call, but I'll send all your information to the New England Innocence Project. So then I got involved with the New England Innocence Project, and they found the evidence. They got DNA testing, and it proved that there was, I think, three different DNAs, and none of them were mine. And I was released on April 3rd.
Excellent. Now, we're going to bring J.W. Carney on in 1 minute. So let me just ask you one more question before we bring him on. And that is, you're seeing Phil Donahue. I mean, it just doesn't strike me that Phil Donahue is normal prison TV fare. Is that just a lucky coincidence that changes the course of your life?
Someone else was watching it and yelled up to me and said, Dennis, put on Phil Donahue. They're doing something about the Innocence Project in DNA. And he goes, I don't know what it's about, but it's something about they had these guys free through DNA.
Okay. J.W. Carney, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, let me give you a quick intro. And then you haven't heard what's been said so far. You just got on the line. But you know Dennis's story very well. J.W. Carney is an attorney in Boston. He was a public defender for 5 years and then a prosecutor for the next 5 years, during which time he prosecuted Dennis Mayer. He's listed in the current edition of Best Lawyers in America, recently was named one of the top six criminal defense attorneys. He's gone to the defense side in Massachusetts by Boston Magazine. I'm Terry McNally, and I'm speaking about the lives and the cases of wrongly convicted prisoners who have been exonerated and freed by DNA evidence. And the documentary film, After Innocence, which tells their stories, opens Friday the 13th at the New Art Theater in West L.A., and then in select theaters around the country over the next several weeks. My guests include Jessica Sanders, the director, producer, and writer of the film, Mark Simon, a producer and writer of the film and a former attorney with the Innocence Project, Herman Atkins, exonerated and released in 2001 after 13 years in prison. Herman lives in the L.A. County area. Dennis Mayer, exonerated and released in 2003 after 19 years in prison. Dennis lives in Massachusetts. And J.W. Carney, who prosecuted Dennis Mayer. And before I talk to you, J.W., I just want to give people some websites. If you want to learn more about this issue, and I really recommend you do, you can look at afterinnocence.com, which is the website of the film. That's afterinnocence, one word, .com. Also, innocenceproject.org, which is the Innocence Project, the spearhead organization. Exonerated.org, which I guess is Ms. Volans,
right.
Dr. Volans' organization. And activevoice.net. Okay. J.W. Carney, what was your role in Dennis Mayer's exoneration?
After he was arrested and charged with rape, based on one incident, and attempted rape based on a second incident, I was assigned the case to prosecute. He was subsequently charged with a third offense, another charge of rape that was a third incident.
Okay. And you were the prosecutor on all three of those?
Yes.
And I asked him before you got on the line, what was the basis? It struck me as you know, as a listener, a reader, it's hard to understand how three different people could wrongly identify the same person, three different cases. Looking back on it, how did that happen?
I don't know. I know from my own experience in the criminal justice system as a prosecutor and also as a defense counsel that it's very common that cases of misidentification occur. It's much, much more difficult for people involved in a traumatic incident to be able to accurately identify the perpetrator at a later point. Also, the procedures that are used by many jurisdictions and certainly were used by the Massachusetts jurisdiction back then are not the very best way that you can even assist a witness to identify someone. I wasn't present when the police showed photographs to the victims, and I wasn't present when they selected Dennis's photograph. So I'm not familiar with those procedures and whether there were flaws involved in them that would have contributed to the wrongful identification of Dennis. We know that the actual perpetrators of the two rapes, whose DNA we now know, were not among the photographs who were shown to the victims. So I don't know how the misidentification occurred. I just know, without any doubt whatsoever, that Dennis was not the person responsible for those crimes.
And you left the prosecution side, and am now a defense attorney. Did any of these revelations have a hand in that?
No. I had spent 5 years as a prosecutor and just felt I wanted to have a new challenge in life, so I left the office. I'd also been in the public sector for 10 years, and as someone with a young family, there were also pressures that were brought to bear then also.
Okay. The other thing that Dennis shared when he was saying about his journey toward freedom was that you actually had a hand in that as well. Is that correct?
Well, it's funny because since I've become a private practice criminal defense lawyer in 1989, I've had more than my share of very high-profile cases in Massachusetts, ones that have garnered even national publicity. And I was approached by a reporter who wanted to do a very in-depth story, sort of like the type of profile you see in the New Yorker magazine, about one of my defense cases. And he wanted a suggestion from me about what case he should really look into in extraordinary depth. And I remember talking to this reporter, and I said, you know, instead of looking at one of my defense cases, I would suggest that there was a case I handled as a prosecutor that you might want to take a look at. And I told him that I had no direct evidence that I had prosecuted the wrong man. I had no reason to believe that, no specific reason to believe that Dennis was not the right person, but that the case had just bothered me for years in a way that I couldn't really understand. And I suggested to the prosecutor that if he could look into that case and find out information that Dennis's original lawyer, who was pathetic, did not bother to investigate, then he could really right an injustice if it had occurred. One footnote of this is I remember specifically telling him where Dennis was located, what prison he was in, and I told the reporter, you know, John, if you can prove that this man was wrongfully convicted, you could get the Pulitzer Prize. Well, I was present in the courthouse when Dennis was released, and one of the most emotional events of my entire life occurred when I met with Dennis after he was released. And I was standing in the corridor afterwards, after Dennis had got on the elevator to leave, and I saw that very reporter there, and he came over to me and he said, "There goes my Pulitzer Prize."
And did that happen?
Did what happen?
Did he get it or not?
I believe he met with Dennis, but he elected to work on another person's story.
Uh-huh.
And wrote in depth about another.
Oh, I see. Okay, I had misunderstood you and thought that in fact he'd done it and that he felt now he's going to win. Now, what you said just surprised me, because I assumed that when you would have told this other reporter about this case that it was because of DNA evidence or something. No, you're saying it was because of just some feeling you'd had?
Yes.
And this was what, now 10 years later?
Oh, it was
at least 15.
Yeah.
So it had haunted you all that time.
Well, I had actually done something that I had never done before and never did afterwards in any of my cases that I prosecuted, and I prosecuted hundreds of people. After Dennis was convicted, I went to see a lawyer in the office that assigns appellate attorneys to convicted defendants who cannot afford counsel. And I met with him, and I said to him that I had no affirmative reason to believe that Dennis was innocent. But I did know that his lawyer was the worst lawyer I had ever seen. And I told this person that if he could please assign a lawyer who would be able to do a thorough investigation of Dennis's case, and if that lawyer could come up with information that was exculpatory of Dennis, then I would speak to my office about agreeing to a motion for a new trial.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, right now, I don't know if that lawyer will find anything, but I do know that the lawyer Dennis had at the trial was so awful that I didn't feel Dennis had got a fair trial.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you one.
That's the only time I had ever done it.
Yeah.
In all the years I was a prosecutor.
I'm going to ask you one other question, because it is quite interesting when I've investigated this issue before. I've never spoken to a prosecutor or a former prosecutor. Besides feeling that the lawyer on the other side was pathetic, when you were basing your prosecution on the eyewitness identifications, were you confident of those, or was it just that's business as usual? If you've got them, you go with them.
All three of the women selected Dennis's photo from an array of mugshots, if you will, or similar photos to mugshots. And all of them said they were confident that Dennis was the one who had committed these acts. They had looked at these photo arrays separately, so it wasn't like the three women were in the room. One thing I did is I scheduled three different lineups so that each woman would come on a different day and look at a different lineup where Dennis was the only person who was in all three of the lineups. And they came in, and when they came out, they said Dennis was the one who committed this crime. In addition, there was some corroborating evidence in that the area where the rapes took place was near a major army base in Massachusetts. And some of the clothing described and the knife that was described was consistent with clothing or a weapon that would be possessed by someone who was in the army. Dennis was in the army at that time, and he had a generic green raincoat or poncho in his car that was consistent with the description of one of the victims. He was wearing a red sweatshirt when he was arrested, which was consistent with an item of clothing that was described, and he had a knife in his possession, which was consistent with the knife that was also described. I'll tell you one other piece of evidence that to this day is baffling. A person who lived near the scene where the third rape had occurred came forward and said he had met Dennis one night in the parking lot of the motel where the rape had occurred, and that he struck up a conversation with Dennis. And the reason several months later he could remember speaking to Dennis at that location, not on the night of the rape, but on some other night, was that this witness had a friend in California who had the same name as Dennis, and that's why he remembered Dennis's name.
Mm-hmm.
I'm convinced now that never happened. And whether this witness was a nut, whether he was seeking publicity, whether he was just outright lying for some other motive that I'm unaware of, I have no idea. But this guy came forward and said he met Dennis in the motel mm-hmm. parking lot, which is something Dennis consistently had denied from the outset.
I see. So in other words, since this appears to make Dennis a liar, it then casts doubt on anything else he says.
This is Terrence McNally, and you're listening to my 2006 conversation about the documentary After Innocence. I'm talking with the director, producer, writer Jessica Sanders, producer, writer Mark Simon, and exonerated former prisoner Herman Atkins.
InnocenceProject.org is the website of the Innocence Project, which is about the business of using DNA evidence to free people, and exonerated.org, which is about improving the situation and the lives of those who have been exonerated. I will also recommend the book, Actual Innocence, by Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld, which not only tells the stories of many, but uses the stories to indicate the problems of mistaken identity, of bad science, of bad prosecutions, and so on. And so if one says, how could this happen? The book Actual Innocence, I think, makes a great case for how it happens. Before I let you go, J.W. Carney, one last question, and that is, one of the things that I have heard in discussions of this whole problem area is that prosecutors, I believe their mission when they become a prosecutor is to seek the truth, but their goal when they're actually working as prosecutors is to get a winning record. Your thoughts?
Unfortunately, I think there's an element of truth to that. One of the roles I played in the district attorney's office was I was assigned to train all the new prosecutors. And I really had to break them of the idea that they were there to put the bad guys in jail, as opposed to being there to see that justice was done. And in many instances, justice means recognizing that you don't have the right person, or more common, you don't have evidence that really is proof beyond a reasonable doubt that the person did it. And I would always instruct my prosecutors that it's up to them to take the step of seeking out scientific evidence if it exists, or going the extra step to try to find out if you do in fact have the right person. And in one of the life's ironies, those lessons came back to me when many years later DNA now became readily available to test it, and it turned out that one of my very own cases led to this tragedy. And I think that the only thing that has really got me through the most devastating experience of my professional life is the fact that Dennis Marr is such an extraordinary person. I mean, when I met with him and asked for his forgiveness, he opened his arms and hugged me and forgave me. And that remains the single most unbelievable thing that's happened to me as a lawyer, was that day, that man, that act.
Thank you, J.W. Carney. Dennis, any thoughts? You've listened to J.W. for the last few minutes.
Not really. I talk to Jay a lot. We email, you know, and we've actually become friends, you know, through after the whole thing happened and I got out and stuff, you know. So I know Jay is very truthful, and what he says comes from his heart.
Okay. Dennis, before I go to Herman in the studio with me, Dennis, we've heard basically the story of how you were wrongly convicted, how you were ultimately freed. What's your life like these days?
Well, my life is very hectic. I have a one-year-old son, Joshua Elijah Maher. Me and Melissa have been married.
Congratulations.
Thank you. We're expecting a daughter any day. So we have that all going in our lives. We're looking to buy a house. I still work. I start at 5 o'clock in the morning.
With those little babies, that's brutal.
Yeah. That's what I mean. My life is very hectic. You know, and we're also trying to find a house and stuff, so it's just madness.
When you first were freed, finally, did you receive compensation? Was there transition help for you?
When I was first freed, no. There was no help. I wasn't eligible for any programs. I wasn't offered anything. it was the support of my family and friends that got me through.
And you since then, you have received compensation?
Yes.
Okay.
It was $500,000, but does that repay for 19 years? No, not even close.
And just very, very quickly for people, the age you went in, the age you came out?
I was 23 when I went in, and I was 42 when I got out.
Okay, thank you. And thank you, J.W. Carney, for joining us. I really appreciate it. Let me turn now to Herman Atkins in the studio. Your story, again, what happened? How did you get convicted? How did you get freed?
Well, in 1988, you had a woman in the city of Lake Elsinore call the police and inform them that she had just been raped and robbed. The police show up at the scene of the crime within minutes from the time the call was made, in broad daylight, about 11 o'clock in the morning, in an outdoor shopping mall. The police immediately searched the area, couldn't find a suspect. They took the victim to the hospital where a rape kit was made and logged in as evidence. They then took her to the police station for questioning and for the purpose of viewing books and what have you to find the assailant. She searched several books and was unable to find anyone. They showed her a picture of me when I was arrested at the age of 18 for the suspicion of GTA. She then in turn
GTA,
said—
GTA, Grand Theft Auto?
Yes.
Yeah.
In fact, I was born and raised here in South Central Los Angeles. So coming through the city of Culver City at 2 o'clock in the morning, I didn't know as a black male you weren't supposed to do those type of things in the 80s.
Like drive while black?
Yes. I was held for 3 days. That's how they came up with the picture. She pointed that picture out, and she stated that I was the person that had raped her. When I was arrested—
So let me just establish one thing. That arrest— for that charge had been years before? You were no longer in custody? You had been just in custody for 3 days?
No, where that wanted picture came from. That's where the picture itself came from.
Okay.
By then I was 20, I was 21 when I was arrested, you know, for this particular charge and what have you. And I was taken to the city of Riverside where I was tried and found guilty. I received a 47-year, 8-month prison sentence. I was then sent to CDC, where I had to serve that prison sentence out. I did 12 of the 47 years. It was in 1993 when I had the opportunity of meeting an individual who was doing time. He was doing a violation. And he had observed me from a distance, and he felt as though I was too young to be in law books the way I was in order to, you know, to fight my case, because I did a lot of legal work myself. And he had asked me, he said, well, what kind of issues are you fighting? You know, why are you so, you know, every time I see you, you are in these law books. Why are you, you know, what are you doing? And because of the nature of the crime that I had been charged with, I was reluctant in telling him about that. But because I'm a spiritual person, I got a pretty good judge of character. And I'm a pretty good judge of character. And I felt a calmness about talking to this person. And I told him what I had been doing, the type of charges I was fighting, and what I had done up until that point. He said, well, what it sounds like is that you are, you've been trying to chop down a tree. And so far, you've only gotten, you know, chopped the limbs down and what have you. He said, now you chopped it down, but now you left a stump. Well, here's the name of an organization that can help you remove that. They are in the business of DNA testing and getting people out of prison. And the information he had gave me was the information to the Innocent Project in New York. So that night, after conversating with the individual, I went to my cell. I wrote a letter to the Innocent Project, explaining my case and requesting legal assistance, not knowing what to expect. About 2 weeks later, from the time I sent the letter, I received a letter from Barry Scheck informing me that what the Innocent Project was and the fact that they needed transcripts serologist reports, sentencing transcripts, and any other type of document that will shed light on my case. I sent that to him, and shortly after that, I received another letter signed by Peter Neufeld, Barry Scheck, and Jane Green, who was then the executive director of the Innocent Project, vowing to help me obtain my freedom. They explained the process, and from that point on, it took 7 years for them to locate the evidence in my case. I didn't know that obstacles were being placed in a path. Once the evidence was located, they had to go through legal battles to get it released because the prosecutor in the case, realizing the snowball effect of DNA testing and the fact that what was done in the dark, it was about to come to light on his behalf, he refused to release the evidence. Once the evidence was released, then it, in 1999, it was released in August of 1999. It was released. And once it was released, we had it tested. And February of 2000, I was then released as a result of post-conviction DNA testing.
Okay. So one thing I hear, and are you still on the line, Dennis, as well?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Yeah. In both of your cases, in your case, I hear, Herman, 7 years from the time the Innocence Project got involved?
Yes.
So, in other words, you're an innocent man.
Mm-hmm.
There is evidence which can prove that, and it still takes 7 years. Dennis, how about yourself from the time you got involved with the Innocence Project or the DNA evidence?
10 years.
10 years.
I got started in 1993, around the same time that Herman did.
So it's basically, I'm asking both of you, it's what you just said, Herman, that basically the prosecution, the state, puts as many obstacles as they can in the way of an innocent person proving their innocence?
Yes. Well, in my opinion, for those crooked prosecutors, those prosecutors that are only concerned with convictions are obtaining a conviction for whatever reason, such as political aspirations or judgeship or what have you. Here in Riverside, in the city of Riverside, in the state of California, they thrive on their conviction rate.
Okay. I'm speaking about the lives and the cases of wrongly convicted prisoners, innocent men and women who have been exonerated and freed for these wrongful convictions after 10, 20, 25 years in prison by the use of DNA evidence. And the documentary film, After Innocence, which I've seen twice now, and I highly recommend, as you can tell if you've been listening, these are real life stories of the kinds of material that the top-rated shows on television, you know, the CSIs and the Law and Orders, you know, dream about. And I will just say that as I sat in the theater the first time, I was moved to tears several times during the seeing of this film. And while it doesn't quite move you to rage, it moves you to feeling like there are many things in society that have gray areas. There's no gray area here. We should be doing everything we can to free the innocent, to keep the innocent from being wrongfully convicted, and to care for them and welcome them back into society in ways that make their lives, thrive. For people who've had huge chunks of their lives stolen from them. One other thing, and I'm sorry I'm neglecting you and Jessica and Mark, but you know the story was about these guys. I'm going to ask you, Dennis, first, and then Herman. One of the things that struck me, and if either Mark or Jessica wants to chat in about this, go right ahead. One of the things that struck me as a thread that's running through your film, at the same time as it's about the system of justice, it's about wrongful convictions, about these people, is the powerful bond of family love. In other words, we see these parents who have had their young son taken away from them at 19 or 22, and they stand by them and wait for 10, 20 years. And there was something, for me, it was one of the most powerful things in the film. Dennis, would you speak to that, and then you, Herman?
Well, that's what helped me get through living what I lived through, was the support of my family. You know, my father just died in November 3rd, but him and my mother were my biggest supporters. They came and visited me every week at first, and then every other week, and then once a month as they got older.
You know, if it wasn't for them, I might have, who knows what would have happened. You know, but it was my brothers, my sisters, my sister, my parents. It was that family support that stuck by me through the whole thing. That's the only thing that kept me sane.
And they always believed you?
Right from the get-go.
Yeah. Herman?
Well, Dennis was more fortunate than I was. Being that my father was a highway patrolman, and as he stated in the movie, his job was to put people in prison, not to come and visit. I mean, he made that quite clear to me by way of his actions. My mother, on the other hand, wasn't allowed to come and visit me, so I hadn't seen my
mother. Not allowed by your father?
No, wasn't allowed to see me by the CDC, the correction facility, for whatever reason. I hadn't seen my mother in 12 years from the time I had been convicted. When I got out, although I had family support, such as my sisters and my siblings, when I got out, my mother had been diagnosed with cancer, and she died a year after I was out. I mean, from the time that I was able to embrace her in my arms shortly after I was released, she had already had cancer in her body. She was dying then. And we went from out of the gates of prison after fighting that battle and into the hospital fighting another battle, which she died of esophagus cancer. So I was robbed.
So was she.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the things that's disturbing to me the most is she was never given an opportunity of sharing her thoughts and feelings about her son being incarcerated for a crime he didn't do. So she went to her grave not having the opportunity of expressing herself. My father, on the other hand, and like so many people ask me, what is your relationship, you know, like with your father? I never had animosity in my heart towards my father because I understood, you know, coming up in the household with him, where his thoughts and feelings was. He always told us, justice system is the best in America. Well, now I can tell him, Pops, you're lying. You know, it's no disrespect, but it's a lie. And he knows it now. He actually retired. And he retired in shame. But
in shame over how he turned his back on you?
Well, he didn't necessarily say that. It's in shame of what he put his belief in and how he would always tell us about the very thing that he believed
in. Oh, I see. In other words, a shame that the system he sold and dedicated himself to had failed so miserably.
It wasn't so much fail. It was an act of treason because it was one of his sons that fell victim to it. But the thing is he and I, we have no problem. I love my father dearly. I find it to be a blessing that I still have my father as opposed to losing my mother. So, you know, now my family support now is more stronger to the point to where, you know, I feel sorry for them because they live in fear. Because of what happened to me, they protect black males in the family. You know, it's always, I have many devices on me now where people can get in contact with me, you know, with my every movement. My fiance is my traveling companion. I go nowhere without her. I wouldn't care if it's to one city to another. She goes with me. She has her way of dealing with the matter as well. But the family support now is more stronger now than I was when I was incarcerated.
Mm, wow. Let me finally say, what are some things, and let's start with you, Jessica, and Mark first, since we've heard so much from Herman and Dennis. What are some things people can do besides see the film, tell their friends to see the film? What can listeners do about this miscarriage of justice that continues to go on?
Well, the most immediate thing that listeners can do to help the exonerated is to go to the site that you announced, exonerated.org, which is the Life After Exoneration Program's website. And it lists five ways that people can help, whether it's giving monetarily to this organization, whether it's volunteering their services in various cities. The Life After Exoneration Program is the organization that the Innocence Project was 15 years ago. Just a small mom-and-pop shop that is trying to get the funding to work on a national scale, that is trying to get the manpower, and we're not there yet. So listeners can really help in a big way this program, which is here for this community of survivors. And that's one big aspect they can do, as well as tell their friends and families about this issue, about the film, and to come out and support it.
What is the scale that people assume this happens on, wrongful conviction? And let me just preface that by saying, as I said before, if you didn't hear this, the book Actual Innocence not only tells the stories of some of the exonerated, uh, in, You, I know, Herman was freed the week that book came out because I had Barry and Peter on the show at the time.
Yeah, the actual day it was being released.
Yeah.
They were at a book signing. I was being released.
Yes. Yeah, they told me. They said, the publisher said, can you get someone freed this week? And
they always have a flair for flair for the dramatic. My first day in the Innocence Project, Barry walked in on a cell phone and said, you guys aren't going to believe this. Someone was just released in New York today, and he's going to be coming in 15 minutes. And sure enough, my first day as a student in the Innocence Project, someone walked in after being in prison for 19 years for a crime he didn't commit.
But in terms of educating yourself about why this happens and how this happens, the book is really a great document. It's mistaken identification. It's bad science. It's bad policing. It's bad prosecution. But I think what we know is that America is the great incarcerator. 2 million plus people in prison in this country, more than percentage-wise any country in the world. I think China may be the only country that has more, but they've got a big head start.
Well, they say that a 1% error rate is actually lower than we actually think the error rate of wrongful conviction is. But that's with 2.2 million people. That's over 20,000 people who are possibly innocent in prison. And of that, we know that less than 20% of cases even have DNA evidence to test. So we know that, you know, of the 165 DNA exonerees, those are really the lucky people who had the evidence and also the support to persevere after all those years.
Right. And one of the things, if you take into account, oh, wow, we could free everybody, we can't. If it's only in certain cases that DNA even comes into play. In other words, someone wrongly convicted of a burglary, of a this or a that. It turns out rape and murder and a few other, rape especially, right, are the ones where DNA can help. But we have to clean up our justice system so that this isn't happening as much.
Well, there are some easy reforms that are being introduced that we've been able to learn from these wrongful convictions.
Oh, and let me just say one thing as you continue this. This film, I know, is a tool. It's not just a film. It's not just an experience, but it's a tool. And you've showed it in Congresses and state legislatures.
Well, actually, we did show it in Florida while legislature there was deciding on a compensation private bill for Walton Dedge, who was in the film, and subsequently was given $2.2 million. And we were just in Sacramento introducing a moratorium bill on the death penalty in California, as well as reforms to the compensation bill for exonerees. And so, yeah, I mean, I think when we made this film, you know, I thought it was a dynamic story and we thought, you know, awareness could happen, but now it's become a political tool, which is pretty exciting.
Yeah, and just so people, listeners to this show in California know, those bills, if they wanted to support those bills, just kind of track them, get information on your website, where are they going to learn that?
I'm actually not quite sure. Do you know, Mark?
Well, in terms of knowing about legislation nationally, if they go to the Innocence Project website, the Innocence Project has a policy analyst, and they're very happy to speak to the public about things going on in their state.
So that's innocenceproject.org.
Right, or they can even call the Innocence
Project. And I mean, for any of you who missed it, you know, Illinois, Governor Ryan made a big, a very bold move when he put a moratorium on executions there. And that bill is now happening in the California legislature to put a similar moratorium on executions in this state. Okay, let me tell people, the film is After Innocence. Websites, innocenceproject.org, afterinnocence.com, and exonerated.org, which is the one that is the organization helping folks. Thank you. Jessica Sanders, producer, director, and writer of After Innocence. Mark Simon, lawyer and producer and writer of After Innocence. Herman Atkins, exonerated after 13 years of wrongful imprisonment. Dennis Marr, exonerated after 19 years of wrongful imprisonment. And J.W. Carney, the prosecutor in Dennis's case, who joined us during the middle of the show. To all of you, my hat's off. The film is an achievement, and your lives are an achievement. I know that you, by the way, Herman, have a foundation as well, if you want to say the name.
Yes, the foundation is called the Life Foundation, which stands for Life Interventions for Exonerees. And you can contact us at www.exonereeslife@aol.com.
And that's just something that's just trying to help the lives of those who have been exonerated.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you very much. I look forward to being with you again. To learn more about the show, guests, podcasts, articles, and so on, you can visit me at terrencemcnally.net. TerrenceMcNally.net, or A World That Just Might Work, all one word, aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. You can listen to podcasts there at iTunes. You can sign up there at iTunes to have the podcast delivered to you weekly. You can also sign up there or by emailing me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com, to get my weekly email telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and three or four articles of background. You can also check out Free Forum with Terrence McNally on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at McNallyTerrence. You've been listening to Free Forum, and this is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.